You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
The most important question about your child's education is not whether they can read. It is what their reading is forming them to become. Most parents know their children should read more, but fewer stop to ask what reading is for. Is education supposed to prepare a child to earn a living, or to form a human being capable of courage, judgment, wonder, and freedom? My guests today, Joshua and Hannah Centers, believe modern education has spent the last century answering that question badly. They created Chapter House to put the stories, the great stories of Western civilization, back where they believe they belong. Not trapped in academic syllabi or flattened into worksheets, but read aloud at the kitchen table between parents and children. In this conversation, you will learn why they believe virtue is better taught through story than lecture, why children may need unsanitized myths and flawed heroes, how to tell a living book from a dead one, why 20 minutes of reading can change the culture of a home, and what any parent can do tonight, homeschooler or not, to help a child become a lifelong reader. Josh and Hannah, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks, Marty. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Really excited for this. It's been a couple of years since we last saw each other in person. I think it was Austin 2 years ago at the Natalism conference.
Yeah, it's been a minute. Last year, I think it was last March.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, it was. Time flies. Well, let's jump into it. I know we had the intro, but I think just starting the conversation, take me back to the moment when this stopped being a frustration in your own home and homeschooling and became a company you felt compelled to build. Like why Chapter House? What compelled you to go from being frustrated to building it?
That's a great question. So we've been frustrated for a while. So Hannah primarily uses the Charlotte Mason method in homeschooling. We adapted a bit, but you know, really the gist of it is you read a lot of old books with your children, and there are a lot of these books that you just can't find, or should I say, you either find an old copy, you find a new print-on-demand copy, and those tend to be pretty poor in general, or you use a digital copy like an old PDF, and you read it off an iPad or a Kindle, which is not what we're trying to cultivate in our house. So anyway, this longstanding dream of making beautiful hardcover editions of these old texts that were no longer in wide circulation. And just so happens, I went to a place in Wyoming a couple of years ago, met a publisher. We got to talking, asked if they ever considered doing homeschool material, and it just kicked off from there. And that's really just how Chapter House was born. It's that simple.
And what was wrong with the editions that were available to you that you were able to find? What were some of the common problems with them other than they were just PDFs that you had to put on a Kindle?
Mm-hmm. Well, the print-on-demands, I don't know if you want to comment on this at all, but...
Yeah, so a lot of the print-on-demand copies, they're fine. They're perfectly fine, but the paper's thin, or, you know, there might be errors, typesetting's difficult to read, the glue binding comes apart, and so, you know, if you've got multiple kids that you're planning to homeschool using the same materials and it starts, you know, having issues with the first one, then you're like, well, I guess I'll be buying this again. So
the type's often blurry. The paper's often thin. Mm-hmm. And so it's they're kind of hard to read.
Yeah. It sounds like a fiat problem. The high velocity trash economy, prodden books.
Very much.
Was there a moment where one of your children reacted to an old story and made you realize that these books still work?
Well, my daughter, she's five now, newly five, and she has lots of moments where she makes connections that they blow me away. For example, we were talking about the story of Icarus, and I asked her what she learned from it, and she gave me, you know, several little girl answers, and then she said, "And you should always listen to your daddy."
Well, so, she's also currently obsessed with Beowulf.
Yeah, she has requested. It was hilarious. A few weeks ago, you could like see the wheels turning in her head. "Daddy makes books. I like pink. And so she goes to Josh and says, Daddy, I would like a pink Beowulf, please.
So I have to see if I can do a one off of that one.
Yeah. Hot pink covered Beowulf. Coming soon.
And then, Hannah, you were a teacher for a while, right? If I recall correctly, teaching Spanish. You spent 13 years in the classroom.
Yes, I taught history and Spanish for 13 years.
Yeah. And so what did the transition to homeschooling force you to unlearn about education?
Oh, gosh. Well, that's a really good question. Mainly that you don't have to plan every single second of every single day. Like you have to have a plan, of course, but it's not like it is in the public school where, you know, you're working bell to bell and you only have, you know, this X amount of time to complete this thing. You know, it's much more relaxed. It's much more like you get into a flow and then things will naturally move from one to another. It's a really different sort of world when you're at home, but it also takes a really different sort of discipline. You know, when you go into a public school, you know, okay, the bell rings at 7:50. That's when I'm here. Then the bell rings again at 9:20. And this is when we go to this thing. And so, you know, it's a different type of planning and you have to be a lot more flexible with yourself so that you don't burn out, honestly. And I have found myself, especially this year, in a state of like coming close to burning out because I was thinking too much like a public school teacher instead of thinking like a mom who's trying to educate her children.
There was a couple things I remember that were an adaptation for you. One was, I mean, really the whole gist was you kind of had to go back to first principles on everything. And I think you had two great realizations, two great rabbit trails you followed. One was, figuring out how to teach our oldest to read. You took a very, very, very deep dive on that, learning all these different methods and, you know, weighing them out and testing them. And then also, I think for you, one of the big unlocks was realizing that textbook isn't necessarily the way to go on things and learning to teach from literature.
Yes. Yes. I've always loved books and books are always important. And I had a realization a few weeks ago. I'm preparing to speak in Nashville in a few weeks at an event that we're going to have there. And I realized that I was kind of a Charlotte Mason schooler, even when I was in public school, because I taught high school, but I still read to my students and we still sang songs and I took them outside as often as I could get away with it. You know, it's like, okay, we're learning nature vocabulary. Let's go and find these items. And so I was like, man, I've been doing this a lot longer than I realized. But yeah, when we actually decided to homeschool before I even left the public school classroom, Josh here was doing the kindergarten homeschooling for our oldest son until COVID.
Pretty terribly, I might add.
No, you weren't doing terrible at all. COVID shut the world down and I came home and then our situation changed and I just never went back. It's been really interesting to think back to those early days and how differently I look at things now than I did when I started, especially with regards to like grammar. You don't need to spend an hour a day talking about nouns, you know, the parts of speech. There really aren't that many, you know, you can learn those things fairly quickly if you take the right approach.
Yeah, I guess that gets to the core problem of like curriculum designers with like big education, for lack of a better tech, that really try to design a regimented curriculum and give these standardized tests versus a teacher who's actually interacting with the children on a day-to-day basis.
Well, and it was really miraculous to me. You know, I taught Spanish primarily and I would have students come to me who were juniors in high school and I would say, okay, today we're going to talk about nouns. What's a noun? Crickets. They didn't know. You know, they've been hearing that word so much for so long that they've just kind of tuned it out, you know? So when you try to make things have an impact and you don't belabor the point, you don't beat them over the head with it, I don't know. I think it might sink in a little bit better.
Yeah. And I, you know, speaking on the standardized tests, you know, it's one of those things that I support in theory, right? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, we've known for a long time that the public school system is graduating a lot of students who just cannot read. And so we need to be able to filter for that. But then oftentimes that gets distorted by you might call fiat incentives. And what you end up with is a situation like we just did a Substack post about this, about how there are many students entering college who they can decode a sentence, right? They can understand the syntax of the words, but they can't quite put together what it means. Like, for instance, if something's said in sarcasm, or there's a simile used, or, you know, some sort of over the top reference, they just don't get it. They read everything literally, right? There's no real thinking behind the, it's all just processing. It's all very spreadsheet brain thinking, as our friend Ashley likes to say.
Yeah. No, it makes me feel very fortunate. The high school I went to was a private Catholic school. And they basically told us day one, freshman year, like, you're going to be here 4 years. And our curriculum was basically, it basically revolved around being able to reading comprehension and writing. Like, can you read something, comprehend it, and then write competently about it on the back end? And that's through the 4 years. We had 6 years of language that we were mandated to take. I took Latin for 4 years, Spanish, I actually took seven, Spanish for three. But that teaches you like the structure of languages, particularly diving into Latin and some Greek. And then basically reading comprehension and being able to write competently. I feel like just those skills alone, I guess I am a writer to a certain extent with the newsletter, but I think my career path trended towards economics and finance, and having that reading comprehension and writing ability, I think, was the fundamental basis that set me up for success.
Absolutely. The three R's still matter.
Yeah. I mean, you know, if you can read and comprehend well, and then communicate what you've read, that's like 70 to 80% of what you need, right? Because at that point, you can educate yourself. Of course, like, mathematics, you know, plays a big role in that, you know, sciences and things. But, you know, really the reading and writing is the fundamental. And if you can do that, then you unlock pretty much anything you really want to know if you have the passion and drive to do it.
Yeah. And I think we're going to come back to this in a bit. But before we get into like the whole idea of what is education for, just really wrapping up the origin story of Chapter House and why you two believe this needed to be a publishing company rather than simply a reading list or homeschool blog. Like, why start a whole publishing company around this?
Well, really, it was just about having excellent quality books on the shelves that are something that will inspire children and families. You know, the books are beautiful. My children love them. They'd heard the stories before, but now, like, they're like, where are the Chapter House books? You know, they want that gorgeous edition in their hands. They want to be read to out of that. They want to see the pictures. They love the old illustrations. They love the new illustrations. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for me, having these unabridged volumes as well, that was also important. There's one book in particular in the first set called A Child's Book of Myths and Enchantment Tales for Children. It's actually two books in one. And that book, our version of that is the only one on the market like it, because we preserved all of the art in the color. And we also did not cut the introductions, which were written by the same woman who wrote America the Beautiful.
Catherine Lee Bates.
Yeah. So, you know, a matter of historic preservation almost in that way.
When we both grew up with things like the Harvard Classics and these Reader's Digest editions of things, and they were cloth bound or leather bound, and, you know, they looked very important. And I think that was part of what encouraged us to want to read them, is because, you know, they looked and felt important. So it was something you wanted to reach out and understand, right? It challenged you to rise up. And I want to do the same thing with these books. You know, when you feel one of these books in your hands, you know, you feel like you're actually, like, you know, you're carrying something important, right? Like, it feels important, it feels expensive, and it kind of is. But, you know, and the paper looks good, everything feels nice. And so many children's books are what we would call twaddle. You know, just kind of junk, right? Cheap materials. The art tends to be terrible anymore. You know, the subject matter, the language is very thin. And we're watching the reading, the literacy rates plummeting, the reading rate plummeting. I think part of that is because so much of what's coming out is just junk.
Yeah. As somebody who's got three young children and been exposed to this junk, I think I can concur. We don't need a Pow Pow Fish book for Christmas, Halloween, Easter with very rudimentary, like.
Right. Or they're glorified toy ads. It's like, here's this Paw Patrol book. Even if you've never heard of the Paw Patrol, you know, grandma gets you this book and then you read it and then you're like, oh, this is a TV show. Well, I want to watch that. You know, it's not a good cycle to get into.
Your about page asks, what is education for? And answers that its purpose is to form good human beings. What does a good human being mean to you?
Ooh, that's a good one. So just to take a step out a little bit, you know, if you read the ancients, you read like Plato, Aristotle, St. John Chrysostom, or St. John Chrysostom, I'm not quite sure how you pronounce, which way you pronounce it. You know, they all agreed on one thing, is that the primary purpose of education wasn't facts and figures and reasoning. It was forming virtue, it was forming character. You know, with the thought that, well, the other stuff's secondary to that. And so, you know, to answer in a very broad way, what does that look like? Well, it looks like understanding virtue and what virtue is, and having an understanding of the good, and, you know, not just having an intellectual understanding, but having, you know, a truly felt and maybe at least a secondhand experience understanding of those things. I mean, ideally that comes through some kind of grounding in the real world. Why, you know, Charlotte Mason's really big on the nature study and going out in the real world. John Senior, who's a Catholic thinker along the same lines, also had a very similar philosophy of you have to be connected to the real world in a real way. But you read stories like the Iliad and the Odyssey, and you read Shakespeare, and, you know, there's lots of bad stuff going on in those and lots of things you wouldn't want your kids to emulate. But there's a lot of virtue, too. And I think being able to see, you know, through these ancient stories that have been passed down generation to generation, you know, then they absorb it, you know, and we're big on not using didactic thinking in this, where, you know, you get to the end of a story and you just tell them what the lesson is. Things are so much better if, you know, anyone's ever worked a job knows it's always good to let your boss think something's his idea, right? Same with your kids, right? You present them the story and they reach their own conclusions that you kind of gently guide them to. And then, you know, but then they think it's their idea. And when that happens, it sinks in so much more deeply.
And I mean, on that note, which virtues do you think, or would you consider, are foundational?
That's a good one. Wisdom, you know, I would say would be one for sure. Maybe perhaps the most important one. Courage, you know, courage is a very important one. One I think often sadly is lacking in younger people today. And I won't exclude myself from that. But, you know, you can have all the knowledge in the world. If you don't have the courage to act, then, you know, what's it all for, right? You know, you look at some of the, you know, the great innovators of our time, and the one thing they all had was courage, right? They had an idea that might maybe seem crazy, but they thought to pursue it anyway. I don't know, what were some that you would want to add to that?
Well, those are the two main ones that...
I don't know. I would add like loyalty.
Yeah. Honor.
Yeah. Honor, know, for sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Loyalty and honor. I think those two things pair, you know, hand in hand. Because if you're loyal and mm-hmm. you have honor, like you're going to have honor. It's a natural byproduct.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you look at like the Iliad, right? And, you know, the big reason why Achilles was sulking on a beach is because, you know, he felt his honor had been violated. Mm-hmm. Right. And so, you know, what if, you know, Menelaus or Agamemnon, you know, had acted a little bit differently, right?
Right.
You know, would things have turned out better?
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, I would say those would be like the main ones I would be, you know, I want my kids to pick up.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I mean, on that note, how do you distinguish virtue from obedience or social conformity?
Ooh.
It's an intrinsic thing. It's one thing to tell your children you should be fill in the blank. And it's another thing to watch them display that unbidden.
Right.
And, you know, of course, you have to talk about these things as they come up naturally, but it can't be a lesson. You can't do a lesson mm-hmm. on why you should be nice to your little brother and sister You know, we have three children and our oldest, like, well, you know, he was a born drill sergeant. But, you know, the more that we talk to him about, you should really be nice to your brother and sister, it goes nowhere. But then, you know, we'll have a situation where he gets the chance to display what is actually going on in his heart, which is the part that we as parents, we can't form that. We like to think that we can, but we can't. Mm. That is something that comes from our creator.
And we feed it. But, you know, one of the things I watch for is, you know, how do they behave in the playground, right? So, you know, we go to a church where, you know, as soon as the service is over, the kids are outside running around playing. And, you know, how do they interact out there? Mm-hmm. You know, like if there's a kid being bullied and one of my kids steps in and intervenes, you know, there was an event we were at last year where we just kept hearing from other parents about, you know, how good natured our boys were. Mm-hmm. I don't say that to brag, but it's one of those things like that's the sort of thing I would look for, right? Like, do you do the right thing when I'm not lording over you? Mm-hmm. You know, has that sunk in?
Yeah. That's something I think about a lot about with my boys. Now mm-hmm. my oldest is six and beginning to see, anyway, we're giving them some independence. He had older cousins. And so they can, we go to the beach in the summer and this summer we've allowed the 10-year-old cousins to walk the younger cousins to the ice cream, to the ice cream parlor and like get ice cream by themselves. And it's funny, running into people that we know in town say like, oh, I saw your boys at the ice cream parlor last night. I was like, were they doing anything bad? They're like, no. But it's just little things like giving them that independence too and hoping that when they go out there, they're not being little jerks.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. And that's something I always like to try to connect, especially with our oldest is, you know, the more virtuously you behave, the more freedom you get. And that's true when you're a child. It's also true of a society. Right. You know, I can't remember which founding father it was, but, you know, this nation is only suitable for virtuous people. Right. And I think, you know, as you see a nation pivot away from virtue, then it tends to pivot toward tyranny. Right. Because what choice does a responsible government have if the people aren't behaving virtuously? You have to, you know, crack down on things. You have to watch every little thing. And, you know, so, you know, if we do want freedom, you know, if our children want freedom, if we as a people want freedom, then we have to embrace virtue ourselves. We have to be our own primary governors, right?
Yeah. And I think that's why a company like Chapter House is very important. So it's like, how do you seed that virtue and how do you have individual children come to understand that virtue is important naturally without forcing it upon them? And you draw the distinction between being educated and being prepared. What does a child lose when education is organized primarily around credentials, careers, and economic productivity?
That's a good question. So, I would go back to what I referred to before about spreadsheet thinking. Mm-hmm. You know, just putting when you just quantify every little thing, right? Like, mm-hmm. you know, for instance, we just had this conversation about virtue. How do you quantify virtue? You know, how do you put that in a spreadsheet? How do you put, you know, chart that out on a line graph? And you just can't. And I think one of the big mistakes we make in modern education, especially public education, you know, is this focus on statistics and things that can be quantified. I think there's a place for that, right? We do need to have some sort of a, you know, objective analysis, but it misses a lot of just the greater things. Like, for instance, I mean, I talked about how so many young college students now read everything literally, right? They don't understand that you're making a joke or you're making, you know, some sort of absurd suggestion or, you know, you're being a little outlandish for one reason or another. And they don't get that. It's this very mechanical sort of thinking.
Right. Well, because a lot of the reading that's done in the public schools now is nonfiction. There was a pivot to that several years ago, you know, with all the STEM initiatives, like we're going to pivot away from fiction. We're going to read more nonfiction. And when all you do is read nonfiction, then you fall into that sort of spreadsheet way of thinking. For me, you know, Charlotte Mason said that at the end of an education, it's not necessarily how much a child knows, it's how much he cares and about how many sorts of things does he care. And when you raise children that they only see the value in education by like what sort of things they can put on a spreadsheet at the end of it, I'll give you a perfect example. I taught high school Spanish for 13 years, and I had students, like the good students, you know, the college-bound students, who would tell me, this was toward the end of my career. This was one of those moments where I was like, I have to get out of here, because I had students tell me, well, your class doesn't have a standardized test at the end of it, so I don't care as much about it as I do about my math class or my English class, mm-hmm. say. And so, you know, if in all of our educational endeavors, students are learning to rank the subjects by, well, this one is important because it has a test and this one is not, then we've missed the mark somewhere entirely, because the point of education is not necessarily to, you know, well, I made a really good grade and I passed this test and now, you know, on to the next thing. It's, you know, wow, I know a lot about this subject, or I care a lot about this subject, and I will continue to pursue education even when there isn't a grade attached to it anymore. Because there comes a point in your life where school ends. And if you never take the time or initiative to learn anything else the rest of your life, then what have we done? What is the point of education at that, you know, at that point? Like, what have we done?
So I think we tie it back into Bitcoin and the discussion of money, because, you know, so much of this you could call fiat education, because the standardized test is not the knowledge, it is a selective representation of knowledge, right? And same thing, you can make the same argument for a textbook, you know, just like, you know, with money, you know, a $20 bill has no intrinsic value, right? Like a piece of gold or a bar of silver, or, you know, a Bitcoin has, right? It doesn't have any sort of intrinsic value. It's just the value that, you know, the government or the Federal Reserve says it has. Right. So, you know, you could say, OK, we have the fiat money. We also have fiat education, because, you know, you can have these students who come out with perfect straight A's and great ACTs or great SATs, and then just get out in the world and it turns out they're kind of morons, you know, in a lot of fundamental ways.
Yeah. Kids need to learn how to learn. Right. That's, I think, one of the more important aspects that's being overlooked right now. And going back to like reading comprehension. An articulation of that comprehension. I think that's one of the fundamental building blocks of learning how to learn. And it's like a similar, and it's funny too, because I think the public school system that exists in the United States today, it's based off the Prussian system that was essentially trying to create cogs in a machine for the industrial age. And that's just been played forward for over a century now. And I think that cog model, number one, it's very inhumane, where humans are not cogs in the machine, or at least they shouldn't be. They're not things that could be molded into a certain gear to throw into the economic machine. And number two, like, just the whole model doesn't make sense in the modern day with the way the economy works, the tools that we have at our fingertips. And so you're not only throwing students into a system that is trying to turn them into cogs into a machine, but it's trying to turn them into cogs in a machine that doesn't exist anymore.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, for the past, 20 years or so, you know, all you heard in the public school system is STEM, STEM, STEM. Got to learn how to trace circuits and program computers. Got to learn how to program the computer. Right. And now we have these LLMs that do that for you, and companies are laying off software engineers left and right. And, you know, what we're being left with is, you know, so much of that technical work can be done by the computer itself. And the skills that are actually valuable are those humanities skills that we left behind. You know, being able to clearly communicate to the machine what you need, what you want, but also, you know, having the critical thinking skills to know when that machine is lying to you or hallucinating.
What's up, freaks? This episode is brought to you by Block's Bitcoin ecosystem. You probably know Cash App. You probably know Square. You definitely know BitKey if you've been listening to the show for the last couple of years. What matters most is that these are not disconnected, random products. They are part of a broader push to make Bitcoin easier to buy, easier to hold, and easier to use in the real world. Cash App helps people stack Bitcoin. BitKey helps people custody without turning self-custody into a weekend engineering product. Square helps merchants run their businesses and increasingly plug into the Bitcoin native payments rails. Listen, this is the kind of ecosystem Bitcoin needs. We've been talking about this on the show for a while. We know that we need the different parts to line up to make Bitcoin everyday money. Block is doing just that. Check the episode description for the current Cash App, BitKey, and Square links. All right, freaks. You know me. You know I don't take sponsor money from products I wouldn't use myself. So listen up. The Aven Bitcoin Visa card is one of the most interesting things I've seen in the Bitcoin lending space in a long time. Here's the deal. You can get a line of credit up to $1 million backed by your Bitcoin without selling a single sat. No games, no annual fees, no minimum draws, and your Bitcoin is custodied by BitGo, which is one of the most trusted names in digital asset security. Aven never lends it out. There's no rehypothecation. You stay in control. And guess what? You can lock in a fixed rate for up to 10 years. That's 10 times longer than most lenders out there, or go interest only for up to 5 years. Rates start at 7.99% APR for a product that lets you keep your stack and still access liquidity. It's hard to beat. I mean, the duration in the rates is the best I've seen in the market to date. You also get 2% unlimited cash back every time you use the card. Spend fiat, keep your Bitcoin, the whole game. If you've been stacking for years and you need liquidity without triggering a taxable event, this is worth a serious look. Go to aven.com/Bitcoin. That's AVEN.com/Bitcoin. Check it out. I mean, this ties directly into your motto, which is virtues et miraculum, virtue and wonder. And I think we've touched on it a bit, but like really tying the knot here and connecting them very concretely. Like, why do these two ideas need one another?
That's a great question. So, you know, we've gone through virtue already and the importance of character formation. Wonder, I think, is the offset to that, because, you know, if you just grow up in this environment where it's like, you know, be good, you know, do these things, then I don't think you become a well-rounded person. I think that's just sort of a very flat angle. It's easy to kind of lose the meaning of it. And I think that's why so many kids, for instance, who grow up in a religious tradition often will abandon that religious tradition because they need something more. They need a reason for that. And that's really where wonder comes in. And, you know, developing a sense of how amazing the world is and can be. You know, I'll give you a real world example of this. So we had this terrible ice storm back in February. And one of the things that the ice storm did, there was this giant old tree on a hill behind our house that toppled over, took out a power line when it did it. And anyway, so like we got that cut up and it left this giant crater in the ground. Like this tree was just enormous. It left this giant crater. And our 7-year-old boy, he has spent the past few months exploring that crater, and he is constantly pulling stuff from it, like bringing it back to the house. There was one day he got this cart I had, and this rock he brought in probably weighed like at least 50 pounds.
At least.
He somehow figured out how to roll it down the hill and load it into this cart and haul the cart all the way to our house. And this is probably about 100 yards from where that tree is. To the bottom of the hill where the tree is, to all the way over here. And he was just amazed at this rock he brought, right? Mm-hmm. He's just been amazed at this big hole in the ground. And then you go back to that story. Think of all the virtues he displayed while exploring that crater, right? I mean, it took a certain amount of bravery because it's about like 3 feet down into that thing. Mm-hmm. It's, you have to jump into it. It's a huge crater. And then digging all this stuff, and then figuring out these innovative ways to get this rock that's as big as he is to the house.
Yeah.
You know, and so you see all those like sort of things kicking together. And I think that's a great example of how virtue and wonder interplay, right? Because like, if there is no wonder, if there is nothing more out there, you know, for the longest time, you know, the Western thinking has been heavily colored by this materialist thinking, right? The sort of Darwinian, Freudian thinking of, you know, everything has to, you know, be able to put in a spreadsheet. Everything has to, you know, everything's material. There's nothing mm-hmm. incredible. There are no miracles. There's nothing interesting out there. Everything's just atoms and rocks. And
there's an explanation for everything.
Yeah. And, you know, without that wonder, you know, I mean, like you take someone like Elon Musk, you know, love him or hate him, he's done a lot of really cool things. And part of the reason he's done those cool things, well, one is virtue, right? The guy works insanely hard, you know, often sleeps in his factories, you know, just works constantly. You know, he's got his issues like we all do, but he does have that specific virtue, right? He's very, very driven.
It's tenacious.
But then Elon Musk also has that wonder, right? He's constantly talking about Mars. Let's go to Mars. Let's see what's on Mars.
How are we going
to
do it?
What would it be like to live on Mars, right? Like, does living on Mars make a lot of sense? Not really. You know, like, would I rather live on Mars than say Hawaii? Well, no. But that's the wonder taking place, right? Like, what would it be like if we could live on Mars? Right. Like, let's get to Mars. And so and he's done all this wild stuff, all in the service of trying to get humanity to Mars.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you explain what virtue is without wonder. It just, you don't want to be a drill sergeant, and you need to have that strive for something greater. But what's the opposite? What's how does virtue counterbalance and balance wonder? Like, what's what is a child that has a ton of wonder but no virtue? What does that end up in?
I mean, that's a great question. You know, I would say just a dreamer, right?
Or a criminal. You know,
I mean, like, maybe, but like, you know, I'm thinking, okay, so here's a great example. I knew a guy I went to high school with, him, super smart. You know, he would read the textbooks for fun and memorize them, right? Just an insanely smart dude. And the last I heard a few years ago, he was still living with his parents, right? He was like in his 30s living with his parents. Mm-hmm. So he didn't do anything with all that genius, right? And so I think what happens when you have the wonder without virtue is you're basically just a dreamer. I've certainly been guilty of this in a lot of ways, right? Where like you have all these great ideas, all these great things you want to do, but you don't have the tenacity, right? You don't have the courage to go out and try the idea. You don't have the work ethic to, you know, to figure these things out. Mm-hmm. So you end up just kind of drifting through life.
Or you end up robbing banks because you have the wonder, but you have no guiding principles. You know, you don't have anything to stop.
Okay, great example. Great example. I just saw a Twitter thread on the movie Point Break. Have you seen Point Break?
I haven't.
Okay, it's about these dudes who, like, they're thrill seekers, and they're, like, surfers, and they jump out of airplanes, all this stuff, and then they rob banks to fund all this, right? Oh. And it's part of, like, their thrill seeking,
okay.
Right?
There you go.
They just live their lives. They're surf bums who rob banks. And so I think it's a great example of wonder without virtue.
Sounds like it.
What's his name in that? Johnny Ohio?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. Man, I got to rewatch that.
I'm going to get yelled at for butchering that now.
Patrick Swayze and Keanu Reeves. It's classic.
Oh, wow.
You mentioned your Christian faith. Mm-hmm. And you say your vision is inseparable from that faith. So how does Christian conviction shape the books you select and your understanding of childhood?
Ooh. Mm-hmm. A great, great question. So, and it's kind of complex to answer, but I'll do my best. So one of my big influences is a Catholic writer. I'm not a Catholic, by the way, but he's still been a great influence. A gentleman by the name of Dr. John Sr. And Dr. John Sr., he died in 99, but he grabbed my attention because I heard about this program called the Integrated Humanities Program. It was at the University of Kansas from 1970 to about 1980. And it was him and two other professors, and they set up what was sort of a remedial humanities program. They would read the classics, they would learn a little bit of Latin and Greek, but they'd do other stuff. And the students never quite knew what they were walking into, right? Like, they might come in and they might just start singing folk songs, or they would have like a night class. They'd go out and like look at the stars, or they would, I don't know, they would have like a whole class on like square dancing, right? It was all this stuff that, like, at one point in time, every educated person was expected to do or to know, and they just never experienced it. Well, very strange things started happening, and it's what ended up getting the program shut down. But the students started becoming Catholic. And I don't mean just like a little Catholic, you know, like they'll say a woman's a little pregnant. I mean, like, I'm talking like rosary bead counting, Latin mass chanting, you know, hardcore Catholics. One guy became an archbishop. Another one of his students founded a monastery in Kansas. And that really piqued my imagination, you know, and my curiosity. You know, like, because at the time I was thinking really heavily about, you know, how do we save the West? How do we kind of push back against this sort of color revolution we've been seeing over the past decade, or, you know, arguably longer? You know, what is the cure? What is the solution? And so that really drew me into the writings of Dr. John Sr. And his philosophy on all this was that, you know, the key to forming a good person is what he called tilling the soil, right? Like, you know, it's not even so much planting the seeds, it's just getting the soil in proper preparation, so they're ready to sort of receive the message. And, you know, Dr. Sr. tied all this back to he tied all of this sort of like Western canon, all the work of Western civilization back to a central point, which is Christ, right? And so for Dr. Senior, you know, for him, it was the Catholic Church. We have a slightly different view on that, but a lot of respect for Dr. Senior and our Catholic friends. But that's kind of like, I know it's a little long-winded and maybe not terribly coherent, but that's sort of how it all ties together. Is like, I believe that if you look at all these things, they're ultimately a product of Christian thought and or influence Christian thought. And this is, you know, I know there's going to be a lot of parents who have objections to some of the titles we've picked. Like, for instance, you know, we have, you know, Greek myths, and it talks about the Greek gods. And we have another book on Norse mythology. It was Saint Basil the Great? Mm-hmm. Yeah, Saint Basil the Great had this wonderful homily on the importance of pagan literature. And he actually recommended his students to read what he called the vulgar literature before they read scripture, because it would help prepare the mind. And one of the things I've been finding as I've finally been able to properly read these books, you know, I say properly, and of course we've read them hundreds of times going through editing and all that, but there's very much a difference between you're reading something to prepare a manuscript, you're reading it off an iPad, you know, to your kids, and you're actually sitting down with a physical book and reading it. Mm-hmm. This actually isn't the best example. So a better example would be, say, okay, so I have this on In the Days of Giants by Abby Brown. This is a great little book, a very weird little book in our chapter 2 collection. And this is a collection of Norse mythology. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I've picked up on while reading this stuff, you know, this and the Iliad and the Odyssey and the Greek myths, is how capricious these pagan gods were. Mm-hmm. So just not to get too derailed, but, you know, we're Orthodox Christians. And one of our beliefs is that, you know, all these pagan gods are real, and effectively they're demons. And you read this stuff and you realize how true that is. Like, for instance, Odin, the king of the Norse gods, right? He was like the top god. So like they're like the Norse version of Zeus. Zeus was a bad character too. Mm-hmm. Like, Odin wasn't quite as nasty as Zeus could be, but Odin would sometimes say, you know what? I'm tired of being God. I'm going to throw on a disguise. I'm going on vacation. Or, you know, Zeus would do terrible things to women. You know, if you read the Iliad, you know, the gods were constantly changing sides and just messing with people, right? Like, I'm going to take you and teleport you here just to cause trouble. Or like, you know, I liked you yesterday. I don't like you today. I'm going to make sure you lose today. Christ doesn't do that. Christ never does that. You know, God the Father, the Holy Spirit, they don't do these things, right? They are constant. They are extremely consistent. You know, Christ always loves you, even when he's disappointed in you, right? He always loves you. He's always there. You know, the God of the Bible never takes a vacation. He doesn't take a day off. He doesn't assault human women. And so when you read these pagan stories, for me at least, I think for our children, it really just kind of emphasizes what Christ did for us. Because when Christ died on the cross, you know, these beings, these entities basically were shut down. They were shut down, and this is a historical fact. I know it sounds a little nutty, but this is true. Everywhere Christian missionaries went, and every time they brought Christ to a new place, all the old pagan rituals stopped working. Like, those old gods mm-hmm. just went away. They were banished. And that's one of the reasons why Christianity spread so quickly, because, oh, we used to sacrifice a goat and do this dance, and it would rain, and our crops would be. Oh, that doesn't work anymore. I prayed to God, you know, I prayed to Christ and it rained. So I guess that's what we're doing now, right? They converted for practical experience. And so, you know, you read about these old gods, these whatever these things were, and it makes you realize just how incredibly blessed we are to have Christ and, you know, what he did for us in ridding us of such an ugly, capricious world.
Yeah, I mean, and that the end of that story sort of ties with the gospel this week, which was sowing seeds, right? And you know, you said the focus of Father Senior was to till the soil, but I thought it was I was connecting it to the homily this week.
Mm, yeah, we had the same one, funny enough. So you have to have good, fertile, tilled soil to even, you know, have anywhere to drop those seeds.
Oh.
Right.
What's up, freaks? When you take Bitcoin seriously, you start with custody. You want to control your keys, avoid single points of failure, and make sure your savings cannot disappear because you or someone else screwed up. That is what Unchained has been focused on since 2016. Unchained is the leader in collaborative multi-sig custody and Bitcoin financial services that keep you in control. They secure over $12 billion in Bitcoin for more than 12,000 clients. That means about one out of every 200 Bitcoin sits inside an Unchained vault. Their model is simple. You hold two keys, they hold one key. And it always takes two keys to move Bitcoin, meaning their single key can't access your Bitcoin on its own. Just resilient, shared custody that gives you institutional-grade security while keeping you sovereign. Unchained also lets you trade straight from your vault, access Bitcoin-backed commercial loans, open a Bitcoin IRA where you hold your own keys, and set up personal, business, trust, or retirement vaults. They even offer inheritance solutions built for long-term hodlers. Or opt for the highest level private client service with Unchained Signature and get a dedicated account manager, discounted trading fees, exclusive access to events and features, and much, much more. If you want a partner that helps you secure and grow your Bitcoin without giving up control, go to unchained.com and use the code TFTC10 at checkout to get 10% off your new Bitcoin multisig vault. That's TFTC10 at unchained.com.
Freaks, look at me. I'm glowing. I've got like an angel's halo going around me. You know why that is? Is I feel good. I feel taken care of. I feel blessed, healthy, happy. And that is because I'm a CrowdHealth member. My family and I have been CrowdHealth members for 5 years now. Literally this month, 5 years ago, we joined CrowdHealth. We've had two babies. We've had multiple health events, and we're never going back to health insurance. CrowdHealth is crowdfunded healthcare. So you sign up for CrowdHealth, you pay a monthly fee, you help out with other people's bills, and it's significantly cheaper than health insurance. We were on Cobra as a family of three when I left my last job before I went full-time to CFTC, went on the CrowdHealth. Now, as a family of five, we pay, I believe, $700 a month. It's significantly cheaper. They're going to negotiate prices lower for you. They've consistently negotiated healthcare prices as much as 50, 60, 80% in many cases. They help out with babies. If you have a pregnancy, you pay the first $3,000 and the crowd covers the rest. If you have a regular health event, you pay $500 and the crowd pays the rest. Go to joincrowdhealth.com. Sign up today. Use the code TFTC. Opt out of health insurance. I'm uninsured, baby, and I love it. Use the code TFTC at joincrowdhealth.com and you'll get $99 a month for the first 3 months that you're on the CrowdHealth platform in the community. Bitcoiners, you found sovereign money. Now find sovereign health and sovereign healthcare.
I mean, and let's get like really into the meat of it, like around virtue and courage and these old books. Like, I mean, I think we started this part of the conversation, but really digging into it. Why is courage better taught through Horatius at the bridge, Beowulf facing the dragon, or Odysseus trying to return home than through an explicit lesson about courage?
I mean, to me, those are explicit lessons about courage. They may not be dressed up, you know, with a heading at the top that says today's lesson is about courage and a worksheet at the end to fill out. But, you know, how can you not be inspired to be brave when you hear about Beowulf showing up and saying, you got a problem? Yo, I'll solve it. You know, I mean, how can you not be inspired to be brave? And it's funny enough, like we just got to the part where Beowulf takes on Grendel and pulls his arm off, not to spoil really old
spoilers for anyone,
and nails it to the wall. And then, you know, the next day, my middle child comes up to me and says, Mom, is Beowulf a saint? So, you know, he's already thinking along those lines. You know, these men who do great deeds, like they are, you know, they're saints of the church. So it's really interesting to me to watching him make those connections between things that like I never said, hey, you know, the saints of the church had courage. He's just picked up on that's a through line, hearing the different saints' lives. So I don't know. Do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah. I mean, I think it goes to like living versus dead texts. Mm-hmm. You know, a dead text would be something like a textbook and it just tells you, hey, you know, be brave. Like, okay, what do I do with that?
Yeah, right. You like, does reading the dictionary do it? Like, no. Is that enough? You know, I don't know. Like, for me, it's seeing these things in action and right, giving it time to settle into your mind, and then being able to act from that when the opportunity arises.
And I think it also helps when you see characters that are not Mary Sue's. They're not perfect. Mm-hmm. They're flawed in many ways. Right. You take someone like Achilles, who certainly had his fair share of flaws, sure, but you know, when the time came, you know, he was bold, he was brave, mm-hmm, all this stuff, right? So I think you need three-dimensional characters. And again, you know, to kind of go back to scripture, you know, that's one of the things, you know, I've became a believer and I really started reading scripture that convinced me of the truth of it, was that you look at these characters throughout the Bible and they have flaws, right? And Moses right. had a temper. Abraham kept trying to sell out his wife right, because he was right. scared.
Something that just dawned on me literally last week was that, you know, when Jesus was arrested, that the disciples fled because they weren't 100% certain. It's like, maybe he wasn't the Christ. You know, that they were like, we're going to run away. We're going to let this play out because, you know, we're doubting right now. And it had never occurred to me that that was why they fled, you know? So anyway, seeing the flaws, but then the return to belief of these people, you know,
right. The redemption and the greatness they did, you know, like St. Peter, you know, he denied Christ three times, mm-hmm. you know, and like, okay, well, why wasn't he like Judas? Well, because Judas, you know, he could not accept God's forgiveness, but Peter could. And that was the difference, but you know, that's why one's a saint and one's in hell. It works so much better when you see an example of someone who just is not perfect, who has fear, who has anger, who has lusts, you know, like King David or, you know, or Solomon, right? And they have these real flaws, then it lets you know that you too can aspire to this sort of greatness, even if you have your own weaknesses and your own problems, as we all do.
Yeah. I mean, and you touched on in the beginning of the discussion, like you really don't want to finish a story and then be like, all right, here's the lesson. But mm-hmm. like, how do you explain the moral or let the child live with the story and then like pull that out and be there for them?
We try our best not to explain things. So we practice something called narration, which is common in Charlotte Mason circles, but also in the classical world. So you read something to a child, and then you ask them to tell the story back to you. And, you know, if they get something glaringly wrong, you might fix it. But otherwise, you just let them tell you what they got out of it. And that comes from a place of respecting them as a person. So, for example, you know, if Josh and I read the same book, you know, he'll get different things out of it than I will. Just as it would be, you know, Marty, if we read a book, all three of us, and we talked about it, you know, we would all get different ideas from it. So you let the child tell you what they got from it, and then you leave it at that. And you layer things on year after year, you know, reading after reading. And over time, then they'll start making connections between the stories themselves. So, you know, for example, my oldest, he came to me when he loves to come to me when I'm cooking dinner. I don't know why he does this to me. You know, it'll be like a pivotal moment where if I don't do this, dinner is ruined. Hey, Mom, I've been thinking really right now. So he read the Harry Potter series in the spring for the first time. But we were also reading Oliver Twist for school. He was reading Harry Potter for fun, Oliver Twist for school. And so he comes to me one night. He says, Mom, I've been thinking, Harry Potter and Oliver Twist, you know, they're both orphans. And then he goes on to tell me all the similarities that he sees between their stories. And I was just like, wow, I'm going to have to sit down and take notes because this is just blowing me away. So, you know, that's what we do. We let the child sit with the story where they are, and then you just keep going. You just keep plowing. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, eventually the soil will be good and worked, and yep. then those seeds will start to bloom.
And you give them all these different stories, and they make all these, like, all mm-hmm. these connections between them, right? And, like, you know, all these connections that our kids have made between, you know, these stories and, of course, other ones they've read. Mm-hmm. For our oldest, he's read a lot of Harry Potter, which not my favorite, but at least he's reading. But you know, he's made a lot of connections between Harry Potter and scripture, for instance, and he'll make connections between that and some of these stories as well. Mm-hmm. Was it Harris that pointed out that Ron, Hermione, and Ron were like three parts of the tripartite soul?
We have lots of talks about the tripartite soul and, you know, which characters in the Harry Potter series fit where in that model. It's really interesting, you know. Well, and that was a case where, like, I introduced that concept and then he just started going with it and plugging things in. And, like, we have three children. And so they'll regularly have discussions about which one of them is the brain, which one is the heart, which one is the stomach. And, you know, it kind of changes a little bit day to day.
Yeah. And the thing you'll see if you stick with this sort of method for long enough is just all these connections mm-hmm. they make that, you know, maybe you never even considered. But, you know, and that shows you that they're not just reading, they're not just decoding, they're actually thinking, they're mm-hmm. actually truly processing mm-hmm. what they've read. Mm-hmm. You're actually engaging the mind, you're engaging those parts of the mind. And that's sort of the opposite of what we've seen from this sort of spreadsheet education, where I know the facts, I know the figures, I can decode, I can tell you why your engine's making that sound, I can tell you why the code isn't compiling correctly. Mm-hmm. And those are all good things, of course, but you know, we're trying to go for a deeper sense of comprehension.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, you guys have made some decisions that others would say, like, why are you doing this? One, like deliberately choosing an Aesop edition that does not append an explicit moral to every fable. Why is explaining the lessons sometimes the fastest way to weaken it? I mean, we just covered that, but again, reinforcing this in the actual physical copies of the book too.
Yeah. Well, I'll give you an example. So we read this story about, I think it's a crow or raven. It may depend on which version of Aesop you're looking at.
Passover, I'll pull up.
And with the jug with the water in the bottom of it, he's trying to figure out how to get the water out. So he drops the pebbles in until the water level rises so that he can drink from the jug. And so we read that very short story. And I say, okay, well, you know, what everybody learned from that. And my oldest, you know, if the moral had been spelled out, it would have been one thing. But my oldest said, well, what I learned from that is that you really need to stay calm in a dangerous situation. Okay. That's not the moral that would have been spelled out at the bottom, but that was what he took from it. And I'm sure, you know, if you're a thirsty bird, you might be on the verge of death. I don't know. It wasn't explicitly stated that he was, but still, you know, and that's the virtue of not just spelling everything out, like letting them take from it what is needed in their life at that time, well, you know, and that's, you know, where you have to leave room for the Holy Spirit.
Yeah. Well, and don't box them in.
Right.
You know, when you spoon feed them mm-hmm. the lesson, well, first of all, you don't let them engage that part of their brain, that critical thinking part mm-hmm. of their brain. They're just, again, just absorbing what they're being given. They're just being spoon fed. I really think that's the gist of so much of our education these days, is they're getting spoon fed.
Yeah.
But then you're also boxing them in, right? You're not leaving room for the Holy Spirit or their imagination
right.
to say, hey, you know what? It could be this, or it could be this. It could also be this, right?
Right.
You know, I keep going back to scripture. So many Bible verses where someone will read it one way, someone else will read it another way, and maybe they're both true. And maybe there's multiple. And that's sort of the beauty of the Bible, is there's so many different layers
right.
to so much scripture.
Right. It's like an onion. You know, which layer of the onion is the real onion? Well, it's all the real onion. It's just different layers of the onion. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. I mean, Josh, you mentioned earlier that it's important that children understand flawed heroes rather mm-hmm. than impossible models of perfection. Which flawed heroes have prompted the richest conversations in your home?
Oh.
Oh, gosh.
Well, I'll tell you a favorite one of mine. My kids don't know quite as much about this one yet. You'll understand why in a second. But so one of my favorite saints is Saint Mary of Egypt. And I really think she's a saint for this age. So Saint Mary of Egypt was, for lack of a better word, a nymphomaniac. And she was just going out, just committing all sorts of terrible sins and just having a great time of it. And she went on a pilgrimage kind of as a gag. And she tried to go into this church and she couldn't get inside the church. Like, I'm not quite sure how that worked. I don't know if like she was like, there's a force field or she just kept trying to go in and getting redirected, but she couldn't get inside this church. And finally, she cries out to this icon of the Theotokos, the Virgin Mary. And Mary tells her, like, hey, you need to go to the desert and you need to repent. And so she's finally let in the church. She goes to confession, she communes, then she goes out in the desert. She spends the rest of her life living in the desert and just repenting and praying and all this stuff. And, you know, and so she's found by this monk named Saint Zosimus, who she recounts her entire life story to him. And she dies this sort of beautiful death. And, you know, but before she does, she walks on water to go visit him one last time. And she's this wonderful saint who lived this very sinful life. But, you know, but because she made that choice to repent, she made that decision, then, you know, she's counted amongst the saints. And I think that's a beautiful story, because I think there's so many people these days who, you know, they fall into this sort of stuff. And it shows there is a path, right? There is a path to holiness from that.
Yeah. And again, I think it's very humanizing, right? Like, there is no such thing as a perfect hero other than Jesus, right?
And right, exactly.
Yeah.
It's okay to be flawed. It's natural.
And I think there's certain people who take advantage of that these days, right? Like, that, you know, you'll bring up like Thomas Jefferson or George Washington, and someone will be like, well, they owned slaves. They did this. They did that. And it's like, okay, well, you know what? I can take literally any, you know, hero from history, and I can point out all their flaws. You know, I can point out all the flaws of Martin Luther King Jr. I can point out all the flaws of Martin Luther. I could point out, like, I could take literally anyone apart that you wanted me to, you know? Sure. But that's not the point. The point is, you know, when we rise from that default state, right? We rise beyond, you know, we do something greater than ourselves, right? That's why we remember these people in history.
Yeah. And that gets to, I mean, your selection standard is that a book should be beautiful, it should be true, and worth reading aloud. And obviously, as we covered, a lot of these stories are myths, ancient myths, and obviously they're not true, but what does it mean to be true? Like, what is the truth embedded in these myths?
That's a great question. So yeah, I mean, there was a lot of deliberation of which books to include, and we came up with four box sets, three books a piece, so 12 books total. And you know, so we kind of came to the question of, well, how do you sum up the Western canon in 12 books? Mm-hmm. And so some things are obvious, right? Like Shakespeare, Homer, you know, Aesop, I think were all obvious things. And then some other ones for us were obvious. You know, for instance, 50 Famous Stories We Told, that's a very popular book in Charlotte Mason circles. But then, you know, how do you get to true? And, you know, and how do you kind of tease apart truth and myth? Well, see, I would argue that myth is a little different than just fiction. You know, because myth, you know, may have happened, may not have happened, but there's truth in it. You know, for instance, you know, oftentimes we would call, you know, the story of the Iliad a myth, but, you know, and for a long time, historians didn't think Troy existed. They thought it was a fictitious city. And then a few years ago, archaeologists found Troy. So we know it was a real city.
Right.
And then the question is, well, how much of the Iliad was actually true? Give a great illustration of that. You know, we're just celebrating America's 250th anniversary. So to tie our first president in with another great president. So one of those stories we have in 50 Famous Stories We Told is the story of George Washington and the cherry tree. Probably entirely made up by a guy named, was it Mason Weems?
That's right.
Yeah. So after Washington died, he was a Methodist minister and a traveling book peddler, and just one of those kind of early 19th century characters. And he suddenly decides, you know what? I'm going to write a biography of George Washington, like a biography you've never read before, because he probably made up. Well, he claimed he interviewed like long lost cousins and stuff. You know, so whether that's true or not, who really knows? But anyway, so the story of George Washington, the cherry tree. I think most American children have heard it at one point in time. And basically, Washington's dad had a cherry tree that was kind of rare and valuable at the time. You couldn't exactly go to the Walmart and get a cherry tree. And George Washington had a hatchet. And he's like, no, it'd be really cool if I chopped down that cherry tree. You know, and there's so much truth in that, because it's such a little boy thing to do. Really, it's like, there's a tree. I got a hatchet. Let's try this thing out. You know?
Exactly.
But then, of course, you know, Washington cuts down the cherry tree. His dad gets really angry about it. And George Washington's like, well, I cannot tell a lie. I cut down the cherry tree. And his dad forgives him and embraces him. And, you know, and so was that story true? You know, there's a lot of debate about that. A lot of people would say probably not true, probably just more mythological in character. But there are truths in it, right? We know Washington was a man of great honesty and virtue. And also a man of action. I could definitely see a young George Washington cutting down a cherry tree. I'm also, of course, the virtue of forgiveness. So in that, you have a lot of truth. But then here's where things kind of get interesting and the real truth comes in. So there's a young boy many years later who borrowed this book from a neighbor and just became this biography of Washington and just became obsessed with it. Just there's only a book he read. He read to the point he ruined it. Like he ended up like getting rained on because he was reading outside. and he had to work for his neighbor to replace the book. So that was a very famous story. Well, that boy was Abraham Lincoln. Hmm. And after he won the election, the presidency, one of the first speeches he gave, he spent like an hour talking about that book. Because back then, like, speeches lasted all day. You know, people think Donald Trump rambles. Like, these guys, right. They went on. Like, you know, yeah. It was like a speech was a day-long event. So, yeah, he spent a very large portion of the speech just talking about that book and that biography and the story of Washington and how it inspired him to you know, eventually run for president. And so, I don't know, you know, people have complex feelings about Lincoln, love him or hate him, though. But that is the truth of it, is that this, you know, quote unquote myth about George Washington inspired Abraham Lincoln, you know, to do what he did. Right. Mm-hmm. So, like, whether the story was true or not, the effect of the story was very much true.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fascinating. We need to get back to this. I'm very happy you guys started Chapter House. And I think just continuing down this vein, like, why should children encounter unsanitized myths with real consequences, frightening monsters, concepts like death? And how do you sort of filter or understand when a child's ready to hear those stories?
Mm.
Well, I mean, they're going to encounter things like that in life. And I forget if I think C.S. Lewis and Chesterton both said something very similar about letting a child encounter those things in a story so that they will know that those things can be overcome. You know,
that was, it was Lewis who said that, you know, the child doesn't have to be told about the monster. He needs to hear that the monster could be slain.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. That you already know as a child that there are scary things in the world. You don't have to be alive very long to find out that the world can be a scary place. But when you read about someone having an encounter with a terrifying dragon and overcoming it, then, you know, it gives you some hope. You also see sometimes that things don't work out, but people go on anyway. And, you know, that also gives you hope, but in a different sort of way, that, you know, if you have a terrible situation in life and things go poorly, that, you know, you will be able to carry on.
Or sometimes you don't, you know, like there's a lot of the stories in Margaret Evans Price collection we have here, A Child's Book of Myths and Enchantment Tales. These are the Greek myths, and they're beautiful, but they're real. Most of them are really freaking sad.
Well, you know, you're Icarus and you make your wings out of fly too close to the sun, you know, and that's also a reality that has to be dealt with.
You know, a lot of times, though, the terrible things that happen to the characters in these stories are because they ignore warnings, they ignore good counsel. Mm-hmm. And that's such a common thing in life. You know, I can't tell you how many loved ones I've had who have about to do something really dumb. I'm like, hey, you shouldn't do that. Mm-hmm. You can't tell me what to do. And then they go to do the dumb thing and then predictable, terrible things happen to them. Right. I mean, that's a constant thing, I think, in many people's lives. And so how do you end up being someone who accepts wise counsel from people who love you? Well, one way is to read these stories and read them at a young age and understand that if you ignore good advice, bad things could happen.
Yeah. And last question before we get into sort of some advice of starting to read these stories with your children is, you describe the Western canon as a living inheritance that belongs to every child. Mm. What do you say to a parent who hears Western canon and worries about exclusion, triumphalism, and a selective view of history?
I support all those things, I think. I mean, look, you know, we've had some people, you know, most of the people who come across Chapter House and our Substack Virtue and Wonder say very wonderful things and nice things. Every now and then we'll have someone who be like, they're a critic, and they'll say, oh, you're being exclusionary, you're being elitist, you're, you know, you're raising up this culture over the rest. And I would say, yes, we are. And because it's just the fact that Western culture is the superior culture throughout the world. And you can like that, you cannot like that. It's a fact. You know, for instance, I was reading something recently. I was in an interview with Xi Jinping, premier of China. Yeah. Is that the proper title? And he's a big student of the classics, right? He's read Plato and Homer and studied these things intensely. Okay. Why? You know, there's plenty of great authors in China. There's plenty of great Chinese philosophers and great thinkers over there. But he studies the Western ones. Why? Because we're the gold standard, right? The West has the gold standard of these things. You know, I get a plane right now and I could fly to anywhere in the world. I could fly to Egypt and I could sit down in a Kentucky Fried Chicken and eat my plate there, my biscuit, and be staring at the Egyptian pyramids. Mm-hmm. I mean, literally, there's a KFC set up where you can sit there and eat your meal and look at the pyramids. I could fly to Japan right now, and again, walk into a KFC. I promise you I'm not being sponsored by KFC, but my point being is that Western culture is everywhere. I can go to Russia and buy a pair of blue jeans, a thoroughly American thing. You know, I mean, when the Berlin Wall fell and the Soviet Union collapsed, the things that the Soviets are the most excited about were blue jeans and Coca-Cola. Like, we can finally have those things. And they're all products of Western culture. So, you know, you can lob all sorts of nasty, you know, phrases at us or descriptions of that. And we have no hate in our heart. We do believe. Yeah. I mean, it's not a belief. It's just the fact that Western civilization is the best civilization. And there is so much to draw from it. And unfortunately, there's a lot of people who would love to bury it and love to kill it. And to me, that would be, apocalyptic. That would be absolutely disastrous, not just for the United States and not just for Europe, but for the entire world.
I completely agree there. That's why I'm very happy that you guys have started Chapter House and are beginning to reintegrate these timeless stories into the curriculum of the home, I guess you could say. And like on that note, how should families who don't have a reading sort of cadence or a tradition, or just simply, you know, there's a bunch of parents out there listening to this saying, dang, I need to do this more. How do you get started? What books to start with? Does that pair with the particular age of your children? Yeah. Where do you start?
I mean, really, any of our box sets are appropriate to begin with. They are organized roughly by age, but it's not really the age that matters most. It's the length of the story. So the first box set, the green one, chapter one, the books that are in that set, the stories are shorter. So if you have younger children with shorter attention spans, that might be where you want to begin. And then as the box sets progress, unfortunately, we don't have box set three and four yet because they're still at the printer. So as they progress, the stories get longer, they get a little meatier, you know, maybe a little bit more complex. So, you know, look at the age of your children. And, you know, if you're like us and you have a pretty wide spread, then you know, you might want to just pick one and start, you know. And that's the funny thing with my own children. I have a almost 13-year-old, a 7-year-old, and a newly turned 5-year-old. And our reading list is all over the place. You know, we have books that are definitely geared more toward the older of our children. And then we also have books that are, you know, kind of geared toward the younger of our children. And they all sit and listen to them happily and tell me the things that they learn from them. So I really don't think there's a bad place to start. Just start. That's the main thing. You must read for your children. You must.
Yeah. And develop a habit of it. And mm-hmm. It was actually a great time for this question because we've been traveling for the past couple of weeks. And so we've completely fallen out of habits. Got mixed up watching the World Cup and and so we've kind of followed this habit for the time being. I mean, as easy to happen in summer anyway. But yeah, set aside 20 minutes a night. You can do 20 minutes. And you know, the green set is perfectly fine. These are kind of shorter books. Yeah, and like she said, when we get to chapter four, I finally saw a picture of what those books are gonna look like. I saw the proofs from the printer. And Ireland's story, which is one of the books in chapter four, is like this thick.
It's like 700 pages.
It's like two inches thick.
It's a big boy.
It's going to be a hoss. it might be a little intimidating for the newer readers. But, you know, if your children have been watching a lot of screens and maybe you've been looking at a lot of screens and like us, your attention span is totally fried. Then what you do is you get you one of these like little thin books here, 50 Famous Stories, or you can get a Child's Book of Myths. This is actually a great one because it has all the pretty pictures. And the stories are short, and you can easily, or if you really need a short story, you know, get the Aesop's Fables, and those take about 2 minutes to read. And then, just spend, set a timer, maybe a little bit toward the end of the day, and just set aside that short amount of time, even 10 minutes, and just read one of these little short stories. And just every day, I just saw a tweet from Joshua Phillips, who's a big fan of Chapter House. He's talking about how many books he reads a year, and all he reads 1 hour a day. He just sets aside 1 hour a day to read. So, take your kids, even if you don't homeschool, and just set aside that 20 minutes a day and just read one story or a couple of very short ones.
And if you have younger children that their attention span isn't great, we do a lot of Legos or Magna tiles. My kids also have the blocks that are magnetic that look like Minecraft blocks. And so they haul those things into our little bin area and they sit in the floor and they build things and I read to them and it works beautifully. That's another thing that I think people get hung up on, because the public school model is you have to be perfectly still, paying, rapt attention, not looking anywhere else. But I mean, honestly, how many of us totally checked out while we were appearing to be doing the right thing?
Another one I would add to that, and this is one of the places where the public school system really fails young boys. If you're reading to a boy and he gets up and starts like dancing around or doing karate kicks,
keep reading, just keep at it.
You'd be amazed at how much they're still listening. But this is especially so true for young boys, because they need that movement. They need that action. It's not good for them to just sit still all day.
No.
And this is how you end up with kids in the public school who have to go on Ritalin or, whatever methamphetamine they're pushing that day, because they're not designed to sit there and be perfectly still and absorb information.
No.
They need some movement.
And you can't expect a child, especially a young child, to sit for an hour and read. That's way too much to ask of them in the beginning. Unless they've built up the habit. Now, my daughter, she's a bookworm. She came out a bookworm. And I mean, I'll never forget Josh a few years ago. He had started a new job. And at the end of the day, she was waiting for him. She was like a year and a half old. I mean, she was not very old at all, with a stack of books in one hand and her tea set in the other. She was like, "All right, Daddy, it is time for you to play with me and read to me." So she loves books, and she will happily sit for 45 minutes to an hour, even at five. But that is her personality. And that's the muscle that she has built up since she was little, because that's what she enjoys. Now, our boys, that's a bit of a different story. They are also boys. And, boys are a lot more physically active than girls are sometimes anyway. So,
Children, one thing we've learned having three children is that they're born persons, and they're sort of born with their own personality. Our oldest never liked books. Even when he was a baby, he would literally punch them out of my hand. The middle child, that he's a bit more, he likes books a lot more.
He's one that if you start reading, he's going to come and sit next to you. He's not one necessarily to bring you a book, but he comes to the books for sure.
And of course, my little girl loves them. But so you have to kind of tailor things to them, and you have to find stuff they like reading. And if something isn't working, try something else. That's why we include three different books in each box set,
And just because something doesn't work the first time doesn't mean it will work the next time. Mm-hmm. Or maybe, you pause, you give it 6 months, you go back to it. Yep. It's a puzzle that you have to put together for your particular situation. And it's easy to become frustrated because we all want things to be perfect instantly. And it's just not going to be necessarily that way. And that does not mean that you are a failure.
Mm-hmm. Well, this has been incredible. Thank you both.
Thank you, Marty.
For coming on, obviously, and then also for starting Chapter House. I think it's a very important endeavor, and I'm happy to see that it exists. So thank you for bringing it into our reality here. What can anybody who's listening to this has become motivated? What can they do? Number one, to help you. Number two, find the books.
Yes. Buy books. Chapter.house is the domain. No.com is just chapter.house. That's where you can find the books. We are on Twitter, X, whatever Elon's calling it today. CH House Books is the handle there. And then also our Substack that we publish pretty twice a week, pretty very dedicated to pushing it twice a week. That is virtueandwonder.com, virtueandwonder.com.
Awesome. Well, Josh and Hannah, thank you for your time today. And hopefully we can do this again at some point in the future.
Sure.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you, Marty.
All right. Peace of love, freaks. Thank you for listening to this episode of TFTC. If you've made it this far, I imagine you got some value out of the episode. If so, please share it far and wide with your friends and family. We're looking to get the word out there. Also, wherever you're listening, whether that's YouTube, Apple, Spotify, make sure you like and subscribe to the show. And if you can leave a rating on the podcasting platforms, that goes a long way. Last but not least, if you want to get these episodes a day early and ad free, make sure you download the Fountain podcasting app. You can go to fountain.fm to find that. $5 a month gets you every episode a day early, ad free, helps the show, gives you incredible value. So please consider subscribing via Fountain as well. Thank you for your time. And until next time.